Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, let's raise two other questions which are to do with resurrection and judgment. So, session two. In this session, we're going to consider how the Old Testament prophets thought about salvation, the eternal destiny of humanity, and the fate of the world. In particular, we'll look at some of the difficult passages that talk about judgment, resurrection and judgment. So, let's start with the next sort of theme. So I guess we've looked at creation and the purpose of creation and us as created beings. We've looked at the idea of salvation. And now we're going to raise the theme of, I guess, resurrection or life after death. It's probably a better way of putting it, life after death. First of all, at least. And I should say that for me, page 7, for you, page nothing, whatever, because I screwed up the page numbers again. What you've got on here, I spend a day teaching on resurrection on a course, and actually I'm soon to create a video course that sort of does this in maybe about 5 hours. So I'm going to do it in 20 minutes now, what I often try and cover in at least 5 hours, often in far longer. And as I said before, actually, we have done previous Theology Matters sessions that kind of cross over with this. And so what we're going to look at now, we did cover in a bit more depth in a Theology Matters session, I can't remember, years ago. It's on the website, Theology Matters Resurrection, and we'll look at the Old Testament views, the bits that come in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and then the New Testament view of resurrection and life after death. And it goes way more in depth than what I'm about to do now. So if you have questions, do ask, but I may also refer you to there. This is going to be a super quick summary. In the Old Testament, they didn't have a very developed view of the afterlife. Actually, arguably, I'd say that life, land, and love were the main things they thought about. They didn't think too much about life after death. They thought quite a lot about life during life, if I can put it like that, life before death. And because life, love, and land were such big values, they were the things you invest your time in. They were the things you invest your effort in making sure relationships are good, in continuing your life through having kids, actually multiplying and filling the earth in terms of caring for, well, creation, but also particularly caring about a plot of land in Israel, and working on your relationship with humanity and with God. So there was a real focus on those things, and the Bible doesn't say loads about the afterlife, at least in the Old Testament. But what it does say is sort of vague, and in those other sessions I explore 3 or 4 different strands, but I think they can kind of be summarized into one block of teaching, really, that there is something after death, maybe some kind of place, if I can call it a place, which it often refers to as Sheol. And in the Old Testament you will find reference to Sheol or death or the grave, or a whole load of other sort of, I guess, euphemistic ways of referring to this place where you go after death. And we're going to look at a few of them here that are on this kind of weird diagram. So could someone, what we're going to do is we're going to go through each one, and I'd like you just to feedback to me what stands out to you from each one of them. So could someone start by reading Psalm 6:5, and then we'll go clockwise round. Could someone read that for me? Psalm 6:5.
Among the dead, no one proclaims your name. He raises you from the grave.
Right, what stands out to you from this single verse? What does it tell us about the expectation of life after death? Almost non-existent. Sorry, what did we say over here? did someone else say something?
Or they don't proclaim his name. They might be alive, but they don't.
Sure, there's no praise of God. No worship services after death, which, depending on whether you like worship music, may be a good thing or a bad thing. Hallelujah. Psalm 30. Would someone read Psalm 30, verse 9?
Yeah. What is day in the time of silence? If I go down into the pit, dust praise you, will it proclaim your faithfulness?
What does this sort of tell us about life after death? Same, yep.
A bit grim.
Yeah, you're not really selling it, are you? So it involves silence, so a kind of lack of of praise. We can no longer proclaim God's faithfulness. Go down to the pit. So there's this sort of sense of just this thing, this hole in the ground. It feels a bit sort of detached from the rest of creation, really. It's just, yeah, it's a horrible grave, I suppose, isn't it? But also this sense of going back to the dust. Will the dust praise you? I think if you remember Genesis, we were Adam and Eve created from the dust, and then in the curse, to dust you shall return. So it sort of picks up this sense of actually you return to the ground from which we came. Yeah. Someone read Psalm 115, verse 17. No, we are currently in the place of silence. That's what's going on right here. That's it. We've just created shale in this beautiful church building. All right, I will read it. It is not the dead who praise the Lord, those who go down to the place of silence. You are currently all dead, apparently. So, I mean, it just sort of picks up the same sort of thing. There's silence in this shale, in this pit, in this grave. Would someone read to me Psalm 88, 4 to 5 and 10 to 12?
I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like one without strength. I am set a path with the dead. I proclaim who lie in the grave. Whom you remember no more. Who are you cut off from your care? Do you show your wounds among us to the dead? Do their spirits rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave? Your faithfulness indescribable. Are you among this known in the place of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the light of
oblivion? Yeah. Thank you, Edward. And any, what else does this add to this sense of life after death? Darkness?
God doesn't reveal himself there.
God doesn't reveal himself there, yeah. So they no longer see the wonders of God. There's a land.
Like it's slightly more rooted in a place.
Okay, yeah. From the final verse there. Yeah. Your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion. Yeah, yeah. So some kind of realm in which we are detached from God, with a silence where there's darkness, where there's a lack of praise, where God no longer reveals things to us.
And destruction.
Yeah, yeah. 2 stars on TripAdvisor. It's not... Still gets 2 stars.
Wow. No stars, bro. No stars.
I feel like I've stayed in this place. Bad Airbnb right there. Yeah, Ecclesiastes 9, 4 to 6 and verse 10. Could someone read? Oh, sorry. You have a question on that.
The fact that all of these seem to be in the form of a question, which would show to me that the writer of these songs doesn't really know yet.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point. So a lot of these are written as questions, which shows that what they're doing, they're trying to struggle with this idea, and they don't actually have a lot of revelation about it, do they? So they're trying, maybe they've got snippets of ideas, and they're trying to work out their theology and get a sense of what this might look like, but they can only get it through questions at the moment. And partly the rhetorical questions, because they often come in the Psalms where they are being sung in order to provoke a response. So I think there are answers to some of these questions, and the psalmist probably knows some of the answers. But I think the fact that it all comes in questions, I think you're right. Yeah, it reflects a stretching for something that feels out of reach and that's uncertain. Yeah, definitely. Good point. but then Ecclesiastes is less question-based. So could someone read Ecclesiastes 9, 4 to 6 and verse 10?
Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further memory, and even their names are forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that has been under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do,
great. I've no idea why I went all cockney in the middle of that, and the jealousy. I've long since vanished, but sorry. The original Hebrew is Okay, what does this add to the concept of life after death?
The destination is final.
Destination is final.
Lack of existence and purpose.
Lack of existence and purpose, yep.
A removal of emotion. Hate, the jealousy. Mm.
Yeah.
We're all going there.
Yay! Now.
You've got the opposite creation, the no knowledge or wisdom.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? That's similar to the Proverbs 3 and 24 language, yeah. So it seems to be almost an undoing of creation, in a sense. You lose the things that we were created for, dignity and relationship with God and with others and purpose and meaning, and we go into this sort of state that is dark and dusty and sort of, I guess, the opposite of what God created. You know, God said, let there be light, and now it's darkness, and now it's silence rather than praising God and all these sorts of things. So it seems to be like an anti-creation thing. Now, it doesn't actually go into much more depth than this. and also what's not clear is, as someone said, we all go there. That seems to be the case, doesn't it? It doesn't seem to be any sense of, hey, this is just for the bad guys, but actually we get something better. Like, there's just this sense of death being final and dark and but a bit mysterious, we don't really know. Now, there are actually some texts that seem to suggest that maybe people's experience of Sheol is slightly different depending on whether you are a follower of God or not. But again, it's all still vague, and we could go a bit further in this. But I think this gets us the heart of it, that essentially the view of life after death was not a lot. It was Sheol. It was this place where we fail to be. We cease to be, I guess, image bearers in some sense. So what are the negative aspects of a view like this? If this is your view of the afterlife, what are the negative aspects of this view?
Fatalistic.
Very fatalistic.
Yeah.
Kind of you just resign yourself to...
Yeah, why should I go on living if this is my final destination?
Yeah, that's where I want to get us to by the end of the day. if you're feeling that now. Don't worry, there's hope. Yeah.
Yeah, basically, no hope.
No hope, yeah.
So whatever you do here, so the descendants, whatever you do, your hand, feet, mind to do it with all your mind.
Mm.
Yeah,
so you've nicely skipped to the next bit, which is the positive aspect, I suppose, isn't it? But so the negative aspect is that actually nothing we do now sort of lasts, and everything will be forgotten and we will no longer have access to God. The positive aspect, if I can say positive, is actually it puts an emphasis on doing things now, doesn't it? Life, love and land now. What matters is what we do in this life. So
also, if you're just going to this place, what's the point?
Yeah.
Things and doing all this stuff while you're on Earth, because you're only going to go to this place anyway.
Sure. So, I guess the answer to that is well, when I say answer, I don't think there is a good answer, because I think this is only a temporary and incomplete view. But I guess what people would say is we were created to be image bearers. We were created to care for the world. And so that's what God has commanded us to do. And so we must do that. Whether we see the benefits of that or not, for the sake of future generations. So there's this kind of slightly altruistic approach to it, isn't it? I do good things now in order that the future generations get to benefit from it.
But they also seem to think that there's reward in this life.
Yes.
That Ecclesiastes kind of, the dead have no further reward,
yeah.
Implying that all reward is
yes.
current. And so
yes.
If you behave well now, you
yes.
get your reward now.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't
yeah, absolutely.
There's no point. It's just for a future generation.
No. So I could. I think I can totally see how people could get to the point of going, well, there's no point. But actually, the Bible on two grounds does take. There is a point. Like, one, that's what you were told to do in Genesis 1 and 2. Like, that hasn't changed. And two, there is a sense of earthly blessing now, but you don't expect blessing beyond the grave. Yeah. Yeah. Go for it, Myra. Sorry.
The spirit of God's dwelling in us. Mm.
So the question was about the Spirit of God dwelling within us. So what happens when we go back to the
yeah,
to the
so
to
the death, the
yeah? So I guess it's unclear at this point, and I'm sort of going to dodge your question because I want to get past the fact that this is an incomplete view and it changes over time. But I guess what I'd say is that we have some kind of soulish spiritual element to us from creation. And probably what they would say is that the body goes into the grave and decomposes, etc., etc., but the spirit sort of exists in some kind of shale. And there is no consciousness. And there are some places where it talks about being sleep, and actually the metaphor of sleep may suggest waking. So there may be something there, but it's unclear. It's unclear.
And this last, the whole Old Testament, this view is sort of, since the very creation to the sort of...
More or less, until we turn the page. Well, there are different views. So some people emphasise the unconscious element of it. At some other times, they have a hint. So there are some texts that talk about maybe some kind of glory. So maybe some positive aspect to Sheol, where you have glory after the suffering you've gone through. But they're, again, equally vague. So there's not a lot of clarity over it. But, yeah.
Because falling in sleep is also in the New Testament, so people fall in sleep.
It is, yeah. It does, yes, with a slight twist, which we'll get to. Yeah, go for it.
Was there an alternative to Sheol? Is this what they believed everyone was going to?
It seems to be what they believed everyone would go to, yeah.
It doesn't really matter whether you were good or bad. This was what your destination was in.
As far as they knew at the time, yeah. Although, like I say, some writers did think that maybe there was a possibly more positive aspect of its existence in Sheol. And part of the reason that they thought that was because the major problem with this is that it doesn't actually deal with the injustice in the world. So if I said that salvation was both deliverance and restoration, there's no restoration in this. There's no deliverance from it either. It doesn't fundamentally seem to solve the problems that are in the world, the problems with life, love and land, with death and with sin. It doesn't seem to actually do it. And so there seems to be a real injustice. And so you can read Psalms like Psalm 73, where David is wrestling and grappling with this idea that people just seem to live and do good or evil, and there's no justice. And so actually this view seems to be incomplete. So why do the wicked get away with it, and then they die, and then they have the same fate as us? They just dwell in Sheol, and there's no good for us or bad for them. And so this idea, this fundamental idea of the lack of justice, is a real problem with this view of the afterlife that kind of can't be resolved. So this kind of view goes right through the Old Testament for thousands of years. But then, next page, what we find is that the later we get through, there are hints that start to come through about an idea called resurrection, which seemed an utterly insane idea, and only a few people in the Old Testament seemed to hold it, but it seemed to be born out of this sense that this cannot be it. We were created for so much, and yet there's so much injustice in the fact that it doesn't seem like God has actually dealt with the problems. It doesn't seem like God has really brought about salvation. What would it look like for God to bring about salvation? And I think God started to give revelation to people at particular times, particularly some of the later prophets, and then Daniel, as we'll get to. And I think there are particular reasons why it was those guys. But these hints seem to be that God is actually going to do something about the fundamental problem of death. And the hints start to come through a little section of Isaiah known as the Little Isaianic Apocalypse, which is a little sort of nice term for chapters 24 to 27 of Isaiah. This moment within Isaiah's big prophecy where he started to get glimpses of how God was going to right the problems of evil. Let me read Isaiah 25, 7 to 8. And let me just pick out a couple of words as we go through it, which I think are significant. And again, I'm not going to tie together every loose end here, but just sort of raise them up and go, hey, how about this word? What do you think of this word? So, Isaiah 25. On this mountain, have we mentioned mountains in any sense today? Why have I mentioned mountains today?
Eden
was on a mountain. What else was on a mountain?
Temple.
Yeah. Okay. So already there was this idea we were created to be in this Eden state on a mountain that was meant to grow. And so you get this temple, which is on a mountain. So on the mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. There seems to be, this is the best of creation. Okay. The best of the wines, the best of the meats are going to be there. So there's this abundance of creation on this mountain. Not just the mountain or a mountain, on any old mountain, on this mountain. It seems to be talking about the Temple Mount, the temple being the expanded Eden. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples. the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Now, actually, in the ancient Near Eastern texts, there were various, well, Canaanite mythology texts that talked about death swallowing up people. And you get similar sort of senses about Sheol swallowing up people. But here it gets turned on its head, and actually death itself gets swallowed up. In Isaiah chapter 5, verse 14, I haven't given you the reference here, but it talks about Sheol enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure. So Isaiah has already opened up with this sort of idea of Sheol opening its mouth to swallow mankind, and that's kind of what the afterlife is like. But that's so just, it doesn't deal with the problem of justice. And so what's going to happen is this reversal where death itself will get swallowed up by something else. He will swallow up death forever. Forever. Now, I think that word is important because what can this mean? The only way that death can be overturned forever is actually if people cease to be dead. Otherwise, death hasn't been swallowed up. People simply remain in a state of death. So even if Sheol like had its gates closed so no more people went into it, that wouldn't constitute for Isaiah death being swallowed up forever, because death would still remain. It's just people would stay in this state forever. So for death to be swallowed up forever, there has to be some kind of fundamental overturning of the power of death, which probably can only be done through people no longer remaining dead. Okay, these are just the hints. Again, it's not clear at this point in Isaiah, but he's dropping these hints. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day, surely they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. And think about that language of salvation. Think about what it meant in Exodus. It didn't just mean, hey, getting delivered from something. It meant being delivered from something and restored to something better. Restored to something physical where God will dwell with you. This is the Lord. We trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. So Isaiah just drops this bombshell that something is going to happen that will result in the overturning of death. And where's it going to happen? It's going to happen on the temple, which is the expanded Eden. Carry on, Isaiah chapter 26. And here you get a complaint and an answer. And the complaint is this: O Lord our God, other lords beside you have ruled over us, but your name alone we will bring to remembrance. They are dead, they will not live. They are shades, they will not arise. To that end you have visited them with destruction and wiped out all remembrance of them. Like a pregnant woman who writhes and cries out in her pangs when she is near to giving birth, so were we because of you, O Lord. We were pregnant, we writhed, but we have given birth to wind. Wind being that sounds like a really childish joke, that doesn't it? But we've given birth to wind. I mean, wind is just like it's here today and it's gone in a moment. It's vapor. It's, I mean, think of Ecclesiastes when it says meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Actually, the word meaningless is hevel, I think it is, a Hebrew word which means breath, air. It's just gone. You can't catch it. So we've given birth to wind. We've accomplished no deliverance in the earth, and the inhabitants of the world have not fallen. There seems to be like this major complaint here that God has not actually brought about justice. So all these people have ruled over us and they're dead and they won't live, but that's it. That's the only hint of justice. But actually, if they're going to have the same fate as us, justice is not really being done. And everything we are doing is producing wind and nothing else. So we're crying out with these birth pains. We're crying out to God, and the only result is, well, something that is intangible and pointless. Surely this can't be it, because actually no deliverance has been achieved if this is all there is. God answers this: your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, dust being the language of of death and decreation, will awake and sing for joy. You will not praise in Sheol. Now you get to awake so that you praise. Darn it, worship songs will continue. For you, dew is a dew of light, light being the opposite of darkness, which people experience in Sheol, and the earth will give birth to the dead. So there seems to be this sense in which God is saying the answer to the problem of injustice will be, very literally, the dead shall live, bodies shall arise, not just souls, bodies shall arrive. It will be the undoing of the Genesis 3 curse of dwelling in dust. The sense of awaking, I think, suggests that sleep was only ever temporary. And the sense of the earth giving birth is the reversal of the complaint. So there it's like we've got these birth pangs and they produce what? Wind, nothing. Here it's like actually the earth is going to give up. It's going to birth physical bodies again. And this is the way that God is going to overturn the problem of injustice and deal with death forever. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Now, again, there's a lack of clarity here over exactly what this looks like, but something is growing. Does this feel a bit more hopeful? Some of you say yes. Yes. I think this sounds way more hopeful because it not only makes me think, oh, that's great for me, but it feels great for all of creation, that God is somehow going to deal with the injustice in this world. Next text, a real key text, is Daniel 12 and verses 1 to 3. And we don't have time to go into this properly, but the session we did on resurrection goes into this in a bit more depth. And and actually, one of the sessions in the Gospels, I talk about Mark 13 and the idea of the coming of the Son of Man, which draws a lot on Daniel 7. And that's a really key text that I will gloss over super quickly now. But if you have questions about, do check out that recording or ask me during a break. But basically, in the Daniel story, you've got these people who are in captivity. The temple has been destroyed. They've been taken into captivity. They're in a similar sort of situation to the people in Egypt, in one sense. And Daniel writes this. He says, at that time, so some future time, your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep being a key word there, in the dust of the earth shall awake. So those who have died and have gone into the dust of the earth shall not stay there. They shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So here we get a sense that resurrection is not only going to be, hey, good people get a good ending, but actually God is going to deal with the problem of injustice and those who have caused injustice and oppression. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And there seems to be this sense here, not only that you come back to life and then, hey, that's good, but actually you're given a place of ruling and reigning, which seems to be a restoration of this dignity that we had and were intended to have in creation, being kingdom of priests and so on. So not only do we get sort of raised up again, but we get raised up again. And whatever the situation that led to our death, whether we were humiliated, oppressed, completely undignified, there is a restoration of dignity and purpose here. Now, if we had time, I would go back to Daniel chapter 7, which is this key passage in which you get this picture of the Son of Man coming before the Ancient of Days, and there are all these beasts that represent different nations. And the Son of Man is like this representative of Israel as a whole nation. And what it seems like is it's saying that Israel, which is being oppressed by all these other nations, will come before God. God will give justice to Israel, this Son of Man, and then all the other nations will bow down and get defeated. And Jesus draws on this a lot, actually, where he sees himself as the Son of Man, the ultimate image bearer and representative of Israel, who will be given rule and power such that all the other nations bow to him. And this idea then leads to the idea of Daniel 12, where those who have lost their lives, and probably in martyrdom, actually, Daniel is primarily thinking of here, because we know that that happened during the period of Daniel and beyond. He's probably thinking of those who have given their lives in martyrdom, those who have been shamed and humiliated will be raised again to reign again with this Son of Man. Now, so Daniel just throws out these all big concepts, as I am doing right now. But then from Daniel onwards, and particularly in the books that come in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, people were like, what the heck do I do with that? And there were all sorts of strands that they tied together, such that this vague idea of resurrection actually became very firm. And by the time Jesus arrived, what had been a minority view that a few people were starting to wonder about through revelation from God actually became the majority view. So by the time of Jesus, everyone was thinking the way that God is going to deal with, like not everyone, the Sadducees didn't think it, but pretty much apart from then, most people were thinking the plan that God has for undoing the injustice of the world is to swallow up death forever and raise people physically, literally from the dead, which would include some kind of restoration physically of body and probably soul, and given some kind of ruling and reigning purpose for those who have been faithful to him. But for those who have been unfaithful, there will be a moment of justice where they will get their punishment. And it doesn't go clearly into what that punishment will look like, and I won't get to go clearly into that today, but I know some of you have sprung questions on me already about that, and we'll probably do a whole day about that at some point. But this seems to be what the prophets and Daniel are hinting at. And let me just do one more bit and then I'll come to your question. That raises the question, well, where will this take place? Where is it going to happen? And there Isaiah 65 helps us out. Because Isaiah 65 says this, "See, I will create new heavens and a new earth." So Genesis 1:1 begins, God created the heavens and earth, one entity, the whole created order. And here it says, "I'll create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create. For I will create Jerusalem," which was, of course, the place where the temple dwelt, "to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and crying will be heard in it no more." So as we reach the end of the Old Testament, it seems that the kind of eschatological hope, so the hope for the end, has changed from the injustice of Sheol to the idea of God bringing justice and defeating death in a way that would signify a return to image-bearing, ruling, and reigning. And the context for it seemed to be in a new creation. Covered a lot of ground very quickly there. Are you with me? Questions?
I was just going to ask, the people who died during the Old Testament and then would be raised to everlasting life, would they be people who followed the Jewish, God's rules and regulations in the Old Testament? Is that the people who then go
there? Well, in Daniel, I think specifically here, he's thinking of people who are dying probably in martyrdom during a particular period, but I think there is also greater breadth of that. I think he probably is thinking, and certainly the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament writers beyond him, and then Jewish thinkers certainly expanded that out and said, yes, anyone who has followed Yahweh, the God of the Jewish people, will be raised to life. So yes, is thinking about that. Go for it, Jay.
By the time you get to the New Testament, so basically I'm interested that Daniel doesn't think that everybody will be raised. Many of those who sleep will raise, some to everlasting life. So there seems to be three centres of what we might have heaven, the everlasting life, hell, everlasting contempt and shame, and something else where you were maybe not good enough but not bad enough, so you just carry on.
Sure. So I guess what I would say there is, I think Daniel, like all the other psalmists, etc., was still grappling at something that wasn't concrete. So I think that probably the language of many is not intended to think that there are three categories. I don't think he was thinking that clearly. I think he was initially thinking, what's the answer to this particular problem I'm seeing right now, which is that God's people are being martyred by enemies. And I think he's thinking of those people first of all. But then that gets broadened out. I think the way that people interpret Daniel, after Daniel, the Jewish thinkers, seems to be clear that they think two categories. So actually it's everyone. There's a resurrection for everyone, and for some that will be a positive experience, and others it will be a negative experience. Yep.
So how come
Good question. How come the Sadducees reading Daniel didn't understand it? The answer is they didn't read Daniel. So the Sadducees, at the time of Jesus, it's probably not helpful to talk about Judaism at the time of Jesus, because it's probably more the case that there were Judaisms. There were different sections of Judaism. And we don't have time to get into this that deeply, but I'll just do it as super quickly as I can. This is like thousands of years of Jewish history development very quickly. Essentially, what happened by the time of Jesus is that Judaism had broken into different factions who all had slightly different views, partly depending on what bits of the Bible they read. So the Pharisees are a major camp, and they were pretty conservative, actually. And we often think they're the bad guys, and they are in some sense. Jesus had a lot to say about them that was bad. But actually, they were trying to really focus on God's word. It's just they did it in a slightly unhelpful way. The Sadducees, their canon of scripture was just the first five books of the Bible. So actually, they didn't take any of the prophets, so they wouldn't have read Isaiah or Daniel. Or if they knew it, they would know it because they interacted with others who talked about it, but they didn't believe it as such. So actually, when Jesus comes and he has conversations with people, it's often the Pharisees that raise the question of resurrection because they believed in it, because they read these things and they had questions about it. And when the Sadducees raise it, they don't actually believe in the concept. What they're trying to do is get Jesus, that like show how absurd Jesus' position is, because they don't actually believe it, because they only believed in a few limited books of the Bible. And then you had other groups as well, the Essenes, who separated themselves out and dwelt in the desert. But the Sadducees were probably connected to the royal Yeah, the Herodians. And that's interesting because they had a vested interest in keeping the status quo. So the Sadducees were quite liberal in terms of Jewish faith, and part of the reason was that they didn't want to challenge the authorities in a way that would disrupt their comfortable life. And so when Daniel starts talking about resurrection for martyrs, like, of course the Sadducees are going to freak out about that, because what they don't want to do is people think, well, a positive view of the afterlife will mean you're more willing to go into battle and lose your life for God. And so so the Sadducees rejected the view, partly because it wasn't in their version of the Bible, but partly also because it provided a challenge for them. I'm aware people will probably have more questions, but I need to raise this second aspect from the Old Testament, and then we'll we'll come back to it. And the second aspect is judgment. And judgment has to do with God's answer to the injustice in the world. Could someone read to me Isaiah 13 and those verses there? Desolate, yeah.
And destroy the things of the earth. The stars of heaven and the constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of the stirring anger.
Okay, so thank you. So Isaiah 13 seems to talk about this day of the Lord that is going to come, and it will be a cruel day in which God will bring judgment to sort some of the problem of injustice in the world. And this is going to result in the stars and the moon, etc., being shaken and not giving their light, and the heavens trembling and the earth shaking. It's pretty powerful, destructive language, right? And actually, this is quite common. You read through the prophets and you find all sorts of language like this. And I've just got three examples here, but there are many, many more. Now, if you think, as many people do, that the answer to the problem of injustice in the world is that, don't worry, one day we're going to escape this world and we're going to go to heaven, then actually, these passages are like, they make perfect sense. Well, God's going to destroy the world, isn't he? He's going to shake the earth, he's going to shake the heavens, all these things are going to stop because they're not needed anymore, because we're going to go somewhere else, somewhere non-physical. We're going to go to heaven when we die. I'm not sure that's exactly what is going on here, because actually, in the same sense that the Exodus gives us the paradigm for understanding salvation, I think there's also hints in Exodus that give us an ability to interpret these texts properly. And so I'll just skim through two other texts. Isaiah 34, all the stars in the sky will be dissolved and the heavens rolled up like a scroll. All the starry host will fall like withered leaves from the vine, like shriveled figs from the fig tree. Isaiah 51, lift your eyes to the heavens, look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment and its inhabitants die like flies. But my salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail. If you just take those on face value, you may well think that actually God's going to get rid of everything physical and you're going to float off somewhere else. And that's his answer. But I don't think that's what's going on at all. And part of the reason I don't think that's what's going on at all is because the similar language is found in Exodus, and it doesn't mean it there. It doesn't mean that God is going to get rid of everything there. So, just like we did with seeing the Exodus as being like the picture of salvation, now we need to go back to Exodus, in particular chapter 19, and see what happens there and how that helps us to understand language like this. So, we're going to have an exercise, and yeah, what I'd like you to do on your tables is read Exodus 19 together and write down all the ways in which it talks about God coming in judgment. And I want you to note in particular dramatic imagery and anything that explains the purpose or the result of his judgment. So read through that chapter in your groups, note down anything, just whether it's just interesting words that raise questions for you, but also anything that tells you what is God doing and why is he doing it in this particular way. And I'm going to give you 10 minutes, so you don't have long for quite a long chapter, and then we'll draw it all together. All right, let's bring this back together again. I'm aware that you may not have got through everything. That's all right. So, quickly, here's what I want you to do. Just throw out some particular things that you noticed, whether there was particular phrases you saw time and time again, a particular dramatic imagery or anything that hinted as to the purpose or the result of God's judgment. What kind of things leapt to mind for you, Natalie? Okay. So there's something to do with the moon. Yep. Yep. Did any of you get beyond the moon? Sorry?
It's going to be a dark backdrop.
A dark backdrop. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Definitely.
Lots of thunder and lightning.
Yep. Yeah, thunder, lightning, the heavens trembling, the earth trembling. Yep. Yep, trumpet blasts. Yep.
I guess we were talking about 18, the fire could potentially be cleansing. It's not just there as a symbol, it's potentially cleansing the ground and
Interesting. So there's fire, first of all, to notice. But it may not be destructive. It may be cleansing. Yeah, interesting. A lot of smoke, yeah. Yeah, smoke and cloud, which seem to be almost kind of interchangeable. The fire's in the cloud at points and the smoke where there was cloud, and yeah.
It all seems to be to strike fear and awe. And like God says in verse 9, that he wants people to see him talking to Moses.
Yeah.
So that they can put their trust.
Yes.
They can trust that Moses has been chosen by God.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so it's very visible for a particular reason, which is to create a sense of trust and awe and worship. Yeah. Where does it all take place? A mountain. I mean, so many times, it just keep talking about the mountain. Interesting. Most of the descriptions in the prophets, both about the end times, the good things that happen, but also the shaking and stuff, has to do with mountains. And I think part of that is because mountains are probably about the most permanent thing there are. You know, you can't easily move a mountain, but here the mountains get shaken all the time, and I think there's a reason why mountains, partly because Eden was on a mountain back then, and the temple would be on a mountain as well.
All these things seem to be conditional on what the people do. They hear my voice, they obey my voice, and then I'll make them appreciate.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Which kind of almost like Eden, you've got the option here. Life is available, but if you do this, death is there as well. Yeah. Verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, so talking about salvation, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. I don't remember the bit in the story where they flew out on eagles. I think that's in Lord of the Rings, but I Andy's not here to corroborate that. I'm pretty sure it's in The Hobbit. Well, isn't it in... Yeah, well, the point is, it's not in the Exodus, is it? So something metaphorical is going on there about a literal event. So something happened. There was an actual concrete experience of freedom, but it's dealt with in metaphorical terms. I think that's just interesting. Verses 5-6. I'm not correcting you, by the way. Like, you got everything right. I'm just adding in a couple of extra thoughts of my own. Therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you'll be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. So there's a sense, actually, all of creation belongs to God. It's not just about this mountain. And you shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So again, there's this kind of recalling of the dignity and the purpose for which we were created. So there's cloud, there is smoke, there is fire. The people tremble and the mountain trembles. A lot of it happens on the third day, which is interesting to note. There is ram's horns, there are trumpet sounds, there's thunder and lightning. Notice what didn't happen. The world did not end. The mountain did not literally split in two. The heavens were not literally rolled up like a scroll. The world did not end and the people didn't suddenly go off to heaven. Actually, the point was not to destroy the mountain. What was the point? It was to purify the mountain. It was to make the mountain a holy place. So the mountain doesn't get leveled. The mountain doesn't get got rid of. It gets shaken in order to make it a holy place. Now, I think this is really important because when we then get to the language of Isaiah and other places that uses similar sort of language, I think, like with the word salvation, we read it through the lens of the Exodus, we can do the same here and take some of these principles. And so there are two things that we need to bear in mind when we come across language of cosmic judgment. We've seen them both clearly here, and I think actually we've seen them very clearly in Isaiah and the other prophets as well. And those two things are, firstly, cosmic judgment is often for intra-historical events. I'll explain that in a minute. And secondly, cosmic judgment is for the healing of the world. So, next page. In Exodus 19, what happened there was not a picture of what will happen at the end of all history before people float off to heaven. It's something that happens within history. That is, it's an intra-historical event. It happens within history itself. And yet, it is described in language that we have come to read as being sort of end-of-the-world language. Now, if you read through Scripture, you find often there are times when intra-historical events, so things that happen in history, are described using end of the land, end of the world-esque language. And actually what you often find, and I was going to do this as an exercise, but we don't have time, but is that you get two passages next to each other that do two different things describing the same event. So if you were to look, for example, at 2 Samuel 22 and Psalm 18, you would find that both of them portray the same event, which is David experiencing deliverance and salvation from his enemies, but in one of them it is depicted in particularly apocalyptic language that sounds like the world is ending, but it's at no point did David just go, oh, the world's ended now. Like, the language is poetic in order to help you to understand the gravity and the seriousness of what has happened in this actual historical event of God delivering his people. Same is true in Exodus 14 and 15, where you get the song of the sea in chapter 15, and the enemies get crushed in the sea as the sea parts, like the creation water part, the people pass through the through the water, and then the water crashes back down. It kills the Egyptian armies. And in Exodus 14, that's depicted quite literally. In Exodus 15, that's portrayed very poetically using apocalyptic language that didn't literally happen, but it's trying to get you to have a feeling of what was going on in that moment. See what I mean? Now, interestingly, and this will take us on a tangent, I think it is not uncommon in Scripture to put a literal and a poetic version of the same event together in order to help you understand what actually happened and then how it happened from God's perspective or something like that. And arguably, although I don't really want to open this up, why do we have two accounts in Genesis of creation? One of them a bit more literal, one of them a bit more poetic. I think the same sort of thing is going on there, which is one of the reasons why I think we need to be careful when we interpret it to interpret it correctly. But let's move on from that. So here, what we often find is that you get cosmic apocalyptic language describing something that literally happened, in which mountains didn't actually shake and fire didn't actually fall and all the sun and the moon and the stars didn't literally drop out of the sky, but it's almost as if they did. And you're so grappling for language that the worst language you can go for is end of the world kind of language. It's like if I said, hey, there was that earth-shattering event. I don't literally mean that, hey, last Tuesday, the earth split in two. Like, what I'm doing is I'm going for the most extreme language I can reach for in order to help you to understand the significance of this event that happened last Tuesday, whatever happened last Tuesday. Because what I want you to know is that the world will not be the same since that point. I'm not saying that literally the world is different because it's in pieces. I'm saying that, that's the only way I can express it is by going to really extreme language. I think that's partly what is going on here. And what we often find is if you look through the passages like Isaiah 13 and 34 and Ezekiel 32 and Amos 8 and Joel, these things that some of them we've just read that seem like the end of the world, actually they're talking about things that happen within history. And we can know that because sometimes it literally references it earlier in the passage. It's talking about judgment that happened upon nations and not that will one day happen upon all the wicked, but about particular nations that were oppressing Israel at a particular point in time. So if you look at Isaiah 13, it talks about noise and stars and the sun being darkened and the heavens tremble and the earth shaking. But it's literally talking about God bringing judgment upon Babylon at a particular point in history that he did when they were oppressing Israel. Isaiah 34, it talks about the stars dissolving and falling, the heavens being rolled up like a scroll, sword descending upon Edom, streams turning to sulfur. And it's talking about the judgment upon the nations, which happened at a particular point in time. Actually, that one, it seems to be broader as well. So it may well be talking about God's general judgment upon the nations as he does again and again and again. But they are concrete moments within history. Ezekiel 32, the heavens are covered, the sun and the moon and the stars are darkened. It's talking specifically about God bringing judgment upon Egypt, who are oppressing God's people. Amos 8, the sun fails, the land is darkened, there is famine in the land. It's talking about the coming day of Yahweh. Joel 1 and 2, we won't read all of these, but this is really interesting. It talks about agriculture failing, so creation is failing. It's sort of being decreated, I guess. There is noise. The heaven and the earth shakes, the sun and the moon and the stars are darkened. There's blood and fire and smoke, and the moon turned to blood. And this is talking about the coming day of Yahweh. Now, what's really interesting about Joel is, can you think of any point at which Joel is quoted in the New Testament? When does it get quoted in the New Testament?
Is it Revelation?
No, earlier than that.
Yeah, the
Book of Acts. Yeah. So Pentecost happens. And Peter goes, you know what's happening here? Joel wrote about this. Now, I don't think people were suddenly like, oh, you're right, the sun is turning to blood. Like, what he's doing is he is grappling for this end of the world-esque language in order to explain something that's happened within history. So something earth-shattering has happened such that the history of the church is not the same from Pentecost onwards, because the Spirit is now available, everything changes. And so the only language he can go to is this kind of radical stuff about the whole order being transformed. So cosmic judgment is often for intra-historical events. The second element, and I'm going through this really quickly because I want to give us a good lunch break for our brains to recover. The second element is this, that cosmic judgment is for the healing of the world. I think your group, you raised the idea that maybe the fire was not for destruction, but for purification. I think that is often the case. So just a couple of elements that are worth flagging up. Often these passages talk about the sun, the moon, and the stars. And lots of those passages have a historical reference in mind. They're thinking about Egypt, or they're thinking about Babylon, or they're thinking about a particular nation. Now, I think, and Middleton argues this, and loads of people argue this, and I think they're right, that often the sun and the moon and the stars are representatives of nations, representatives of powers. If you were at Christchurch last week, I talked on Ephesians 6 and started a new series there, and I talked about this phrase, principalities and powers. And I argued that in Scripture, often when they think about evil and powers, it's not just sort of spiritual forces. Sometimes it's literal systems and structures and governments that were intended to act for good, but sometimes act for evil. And those are defined as powers. Now, in the ancient Near East, often those powers would be depicted in terms of stars and the sun and the moon, because they were deities that were worshipped by these particular nations. And so in the same sort of way that the plagues in Egypt, if God attacks the frogs, he's attacked the frog king, the frog god that provides over them. It's a way of attacking the nation and weakening the nation. I think the same sort of thing is going on here. Often the judgment on the stars and the moon, the objects of these nations' worship, is a way of saying, I'm cutting off your power as the nation. So often the stars and the sun and the moon refer to these sort of powers, these of these particular nations. If we were to look at Isaiah 24, and there are a whole load of references there, do check them out. And if we were to look at Isaiah 24, what we find there is there's this judgment that comes on the earth, and there's this kind of curse and this desolation and this shaking, and the earth is split apart. And it talks about the earth staggering like a drunken man, which is just a beautiful image, really. You kind of see people like staggering down and it sort of says that that's what the earth is going to do. Now, literally, it's not saying that literally the earth is going to have a beer too many or something like that, but it's, there's something is going to happen that weakens the earth and shakes the powers. And there is, later in the passage, look at this some other time, there is this kind of corresponding judgment between heaven and earth, and there seems to be this personification of celestial beings. So it's almost like the earth and the moon become people, become beings that then get attacked. I think the reason is that these things represent powers, maybe spiritual powers, but probably more likely earthly nations that have been oppressing the people of God. So when God judges them, it's saying, I'm judging you and all your gods. So that's the first thing to note about the sun, moon, and stars. The second thing is that fire features very often. But when fire features, it is not always negative. So if we were to turn to Isaiah chapter 1, I'll just draw out a few verses here. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "Your silver has become dross, your best wine is mixed with water." There seems to be this sense in which Israel has become marred through injustice. And so then verse 25 says this, "I will turn my hand against you, I will smelt away your dross as with lye, I will remove all your alloy, I will restore your judges as at the first, and your counselors at the beginning. Afterwards you should be called the city of the righteousness, the faithful city. Zion shall be redeemed by justice, and those in her who repent by righteousness." God is saying this is going to be this smelting process that gets rid of all the impurity that is in you, all the injustice that is in you. And then verse 31, it says, "The strong shall become tinder, and his word a spark, and both of them shall burn together with none to quench them." So there seems to be this dual aspect to what fire is able to do. It is able to destroy those who bring about evil, but also to purify that which has been made impure. So there is a destructive element to fire, but it's also a kind of restorative element. We could look at the same in Zechariah, where it talks about this fountain for cleansing and the removal of idols. And then it talks about refining by fire leading to salvation, which is both deliverance and restoration. Then in Malachi 3 and 4, there's this refining of the Levitical priesthood, but also the destruction of evildoers leading to salvation. And fire, again, has both these aspects. So it's like fire covers everything, but to one group it brings purification, to one it brings destruction. And so when we read things about fire coming, we shouldn't assume, oh, this is God burning up everything. It may well be God restoring, God refining, God purifying things. The third category of things are the healing of the world. So various passages that sort of talk in grand language actually show that God's purpose is not to destroy everything, but to restore everything. So Psalm 104, for example, I mean, verses 1 to 30 of this psalm is all about kind of God's normative relationship to the earth. So he is its provider, his carer. Verse 5, it says, "He set the earth on its foundation so it should never be moved." So God's plan for creation is not to get rid of it. It shall never be moved. It's always going to exist, and he is always going to be its carer and its creator. And yet, you get later down, verse 32, it says, "May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. Who looks on the earth and it trembles. Who touches the mountains and they smoke." So hang on, the earth's never going to move, but it is going to tremble. So something's going on there. "He touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will praise the God all the time I have being." So there seems to be this sense in which God will touch the earth and bring trembling and smoke, which seems to be a temporary shaking of creation in order to rid it of wickedness. We see the same in Psalm 96. "The earth trembles and yet it shall not move." And then creation itself celebrates God's judgment. The trees sing out because the trees recognize this is a good thing. The Creator is coming to make us pure again. Haggai 2 is a really interesting text. It talks about God shaking the heavens and the earth and the sea. It talks about him destroying kingdoms and chariots and armies. And the result is that the temple will be filled with treasures and splendor and peace. Why is the temple significant? Because the temple is a picture of the expanded Eden. So God shakes all of creation so that his temple, the place of his presence, will get filled again with treasure and splendor and peace. Isaiah 2 picks up similar language about God's temple mount. So the temple on which his presence dwelled being raised up above all the other nations, all the other mountains. God bringing judgment upon all the other nations and guns or weapons being beaten into plowshares, which is a beautiful and hopeful picture, which we could do with doing now. But it talks about this mountain being elevated. And then there's this interesting phrase where it talks about judgment upon the trees of Lebanon and the ships of Tarshish. And these were particular places. I don't think that God was just like, "I don't like those trees." Like, I think the trees often represented power and worship. Trees were often worshipped in the ancient world, or they became the things that were carved into totems. And so God brings judgment upon the trees of Lebanon and the ships of Tarshish. And yet, when you get to Isaiah 60, Maybe we'll come back to this a little bit later, but when you get to Isaiah 60, you get this picture of the temple, so the place of God's presence, being rebuilt, and part of the material is the trees of Lebanon. So it gets cursed in chapter 2, and yet built into the temple in chapter 60. And then you get these exiles returning on the ships of Tarshish. So they get condemned in chapter 2. There's judgment upon them. And yet they become the vessel by which people get to come back to God. And Jerusalem, the place where God dwells, is filled with the wealth of the nations. So the nations that get judged, actually their wealth then comes in, such that Jerusalem, which is filled with God's presence, is also filled with the wealth of nations. What's interesting there is that what gets judged by God actually gets transformed and then finds a new redemptive place and purpose in this new creation. Now, I've just gone very quickly over some big categories there. But what I want to leave you with at the end of this session, and then we'll take lunch and we'll tie it all together later, is this. Four main threads that we need to think about when we grapple with the Old Testament view of creation, new creation, life after death, etc. They are creation, salvation, resurrection, and judgment. So in session one, we saw that God's plan for his creation and his creatures was that as image bearers, we have a task of expanding God's Eden, the dwelling place of God. And when sin impedes our experience of flourishing, God initiates a rescue plan which involves both deliverance and restoration. So the people didn't escape Egypt and float off to heaven. Rather, God came down from heaven, freed his people, and took them to a newly restored land and dwelt in their midst. Then in session two, we saw these themes of resurrection and judgment. So having released the people from Egypt, God then meets them in Sinai, accompanied by dramatic sounds and sights. And the language used there then gets expanded across the whole earth. So just as Eden was meant to be spread throughout the whole earth, so God's redemptive justice gets spread throughout the whole earth. And dramatic judgment includes language of destruction and elements failing and dramatic things happening, but they refer to things that happen within history, not the destruction of the world, but the destruction of injustice and sin within the world. And alongside this, there was this growing sense that the idea of Sheol could not ultimately deal with the injustice of sin and creation, as well as God purging the world of the things that corrupt it. Belief started to grow in a resurrection from the dead. And the only way that resurrection from the dead was going to happen would be if death would be swallowed up and creation would be made new, so that we who have resurrected bodies would have somewhere to dwell as we were intended to.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.